You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, September 27th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So we survived another end of the world.
Oh, we're getting good at this.
Yeah.
I knew we could survive
any end of the world.
A little more practice, you're right, we'll be invulnerable.
Yeah.
So what's the background on this one? It was a religious-based prediction, correct?
Yes.
As opposed to a total crank.
It was
crank
basically a bunch of, it was biblical numerology basically saying that the Nibiru, the non-existent planet X Nibiru, is going to swoop in and start the end times.
Maybe
wasn't
it
gonna
did.
End on the, was it the 23rd or the 24th? It wasn't on the 23rd.
It's a weekend, right?
Yeah. It wasn't going to end on the 23rd. That was just going to be the beginning of the end. But of course, exactly nothing happened.
Well, how do we know if it's the beginning of the end? Maybe it just hasn't built up to the proper
effect.
Subtle beginning.
There was supposed to be this dramatic sign, like a Nibiru appearing over Jerusalem or whatever. It was supposed to be unequivocal.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. Yeah, it felt more like the world was ending about 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, right.
They missed the mark.
Hurricane after hurricane and earthquakes, cats and dogs.
Gosh, awful. Awful stuff. Yep. The bad thing with these prophecies, end of the world stuff, it does, fortunately, I don't think it happens often, but you have these cult-like, figures who, can get their followers to sort of do all sorts of stuff. And in some cases, they have off themselves in certain cases. So you just hope that never happens. While we're having fun with it, we hope that, we understand there is a little bit of seriousness to it.
Yeah, there's a danger. I mean, a lot of people that respond to predictions like this do very devastating things to themselves financially and make horrible decisions. This is part of the overall idea that even if it's not a scam, it's horribly bad misinformation.
But it still does amaze me that people can fall for the, this time it's really going to happen. I mean, it is. It is Charlie Brown in the football. How many freaking times does this have to utterly fail? I guess there's no number. There's always going to be some people who think that this is really it this time.
Yep.
Yep. What's the psychology of that? This was David Mead. And then he said, it's not really going to end on the 23rd. It's just, that's the beginning of a series of apocalyptic events. But of course, zip nada. All right, Kara, get us started with what's the word?
Ooh, the word this week is a good one. Hey, I didn't say it's a fun one. And it was recommended by Michael Jelch. I may or may not be pronouncing that right, from Helsinki. And he wrote, I propose the two words cis and trans. I've been using them myself in some of my writings in the context of chemical bonds, cells, or genes. But I have seen them also in contexts where I did not quite understand them. Great word, because it is kind of spread a little bit across science, but also has some really modern uses. So cis and trans, they're actually both prefixes and they're both adjectives, and they have definitions in chemistry, genetics, and in gender theory. So I think that the form that Michael is probably used to using, it looks like in his signature, he is in a cancer biology program. So the form that he's probably used to using is the chemistry form, where in chemistry, a cis molecule has atoms or groups lying on the same side of a plane, a ring, or a double bond. Whereas a trans molecule has those same groups, usually it's got to be two or more, on opposite sides of that double bond or of that ring or of that plane within the ring. So cis, same side, trans, opposite sides. In genetics, gene loci are referred to as cis if they occur on the same chromosome of a homologous pair, and trans gene loci occur on opposite chromosomes within that same homologous pair. So if you've got the two chromosomes that are matched, like if we're talking about chromosome 1 and chromosome 1, cis gene loci are both on one of chromosome 1. Trans gene loci have one on chromosome 1 and the other on the opposite chromosome 1. And then with regards to gender, you guys have probably heard this before. Transgender is probably what you hear more commonly, but cisgender is also a term that's used in the literature and also in like common parlance now more and more. Somebody is referred to as cisgender if their identity, their gender identity corresponds with the sex that they were identified as having at birth. And they generally identify as transgender if their gender identity is different than the sex that their birth certificate said or that the doctors identified them as having at birth. Oftentimes it's the opposite, right? So if somebody is born with male genitalia, but they identify as female, or born with female genitalia or identify as male. Obviously, things become much more complicated once you start to look at gender fluid, gender queer, intersex, and all the other kind of variations there. But straightforward, cisgender, same gender as you were written down as having been born with, transgender is either the opposite or somehow different. So if we look at the roots of these words, cis like directly translates from the early Latin to on this side. Trans directly translates from the early Latin to across, over, or beyond. And they sort of started popping up as prefixes to other words in different eras. 19th century was, if we were just talking about a place, we've talked about this a lot on the show, how some language sort of starts with a conversation about place, like a physical location conversation, and then evolves beyond that. So in the 19th century, we started talking about cis and trans as being a physical place. In the 21st century, it turned into time. And then eventually it turned into these life situations like cisgender and transgender. But that's very recent. Those first appeared in the literature in about 2011.
What I like about that is you hear it a lot and they occur in mm-hmm. a lot of different scientific contexts. So it's just good to know what they mean, like at the root Absolutely. Level, not how they're applied in one specific instance, but
no, just what they mean.
Exactly
the
what they mean. So then you can apply them to multiple different contexts.
Absolutely. And as you often see, these types of words will be utilized sort of in a more metaphoric or poetic sense, too. So that way, if you're ever reading it and you come across it with a new usage, you still understand it from its roots.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, it's a good one.
All right, Jay, I understand another one of our precious crops is under threat.
So what do bananas and chocolate have in common? I'm sure you could answer this question, Steve. But
they're both in a banana split sundae.
Yes.
Oh, wow. I want that now. You shouldn't have said that. So they're both globally consumed, and both are under the threat of being wiped out due to disease and issues with the environment that they're
Chocolate?
Grown in.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Evan, I know.
This is an emergency. We need billions of dollars.
That's a true. That is a true end of the world apocalyptic scenario.
Yeah. Well, even scarier than that, guys, this is actually a common issue with highly cultivated crops. Don't forget that, because think about it. You know, if we want the food to have certain qualities, you know, like the fruits and vegetables that we eat, as an example, we use something called selective breeding and genetic engineering to bring out the qualities that we want. So when we get the plant to the point where it's giving us what we want, then we start growing that exact plant, the exact plant, you know, like as an example, every banana you've ever had is said to be genetically a clone of each other. They're clones. The world eats, as an example, Cavendish bananas because they have the qualities we want. And there is actually 1,000 varieties of bananas in the world, but 95% of them are Cavendish.
That doesn't make any sense. What you just, Cavendish is one variety.
95% of the grown bananas in the world, though, are Cavendish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 95%. But the way you said it made it sound like 95% of the varieties are Cavendish.
Whoa, no. Listen.
That was misplaced okay? pronoun.
Okay. Sorry.
Pronoun trouble.
Sorry, Whoa. Everybody. Yes, Whoa. There's only 1,000 Cavendish bananas in the world.
Left.
And I have three of them. All right, so
but
so
but it's happens? Not just because of monoculture. It's that the bananas are literally spread as clones. You take a cutting from a banana plant and grow it as its own plant. They're cuttings, right? There's no seeds or anything. So they're literal clones.
Yeah. Yeah. They're sterile. For a thing that is so phallic as the banana, this thing is as sterile as it gets. So what happens if a blight hits the Cavendish crops?
Yeah, right?
We're screwed.
Now, they die.
The history is that there used to be a banana that tasted better than the Cavendish, and it's called the what, Steve?
The Gros Michel.
Yes, that banana, which you know you could still actually get today if you're lucky, but they do still exist, but they can't be massively produced like the Cavendish because they got hit by a blight. and that blight wiped them out.
Oh, boy.
All right, so we could lose the Cavendish variety because what Steve was saying, because it's a clone, they're all identical. If the right disease hits that plant and affects one plant, it affects all of them. So we have a similar situation with the cacao plant. I am pronouncing it correctly. Right, Kara? You feel comfortable with my pronunciation?
I think so, cacao.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I'd say it.
Now, you may know this plant because it's a primary ingredient in making chocolate. And only a few varieties of cacao are widely farmed, and they are genetically very similar, just like the, you know, what I was just saying with the Cavendish. Now, this means that the crop is very vulnerable to disease. And, in fact, unfortunately, these plants were hand-selected in the 40s, and since then, they've kept cloning a very limited set of these cacao plants. So back in the 70s, it actually happened. The cacao farmers in Costa Rica started to see that the pods containing the seeds, that you know, the seeds are used to make chocolate, there was this white fungus on them. And the fungus would destroy the whatever pod it grew on, it would destroy it. They were saying it would mummify the pod. So one infected pod could then release 7 billion spores. And before the farmers could react, 96% of that cacao crop died. And that crop has actually never recovered in the region, and the fungus started to actually spread. Scientists then suspected that it was due to air travel. Modern air and sea travel makes containing pathogens very difficult. This is not just for plants, by the way. This is for humans.
Lots of things.
This is the modern age where, you know, one spore from one of these plants could be carried away. And in fact, you know, they're sure of it, actually, that the fungus from the 70s is still spreading. Last year in 2016, the Costa Rican fungus made its way to Jamaica. And interestingly, drug traffickers were suspected to have unknowingly transported the fungus that time in their crop. So it's out there, and it could be moved from place to place very easily. Other regions like West Africa, where the big global consumers of chocolate buy their cacao beans from, you know, companies like Hershey's, these regions are also susceptible to the same fungus. So their varieties over there, you know, could get the fungus and they can die very easily. So, of course, global warming also plays a role here, which sucks. These pathogens flourish, like the white fungus flourishes in the warmer climates. So it means it's going to grow longer seasonally. It's going to, you know, probably have more spores, everything. It's just ups the ante on all the bad pathogens. So even though the demand for chocolate is increasing, farmers are starting to say, hey, I don't want to deal with this crap. It's a troubled crop. You know, I don't want to deal with it. Why would I go all in when, you know, every season makes or breaks us financially? Could literally mean life or death for some of these farming families.
They should, because
but
it's
luckily,
chocolate.
And I hope you guys are detecting where this is going.
Oh, yes, of course.
Science is here.
Thank you, GMOs.
The scientific rapture is happening with the cacao plant. So a scientist named Dr. Phillips Mora has created the cacao genetic improvement program, where they're now cultivating 1,235 types of cacao, which is great.
Beautiful.
And their end
beautiful.
Goal, yeah, fucking beautiful.
They taste as good.
Let me get to that, Bob. But the quick answer is yes, or maybe even better. But
yes,
the goal is to
the world
genetically
is saved.
We're saved.
Exactly. And science did it.
Our peanut butter cups are going to be.
Beware the peanut fungus next.
Oh no!
The doctor's goal was to genetically diversify the crop and make it more resistant to disease. And back in the 80s, Dr. Phillips Mora came up with a hybrid solution. Oh my God!
There we go.
It's
a hybrid.
Every week.
It is amazing how often that word comes up on our show.
It is genuinely
like in context, not contrived.
The top two words you hear on this show are skeptic
California
and hybrid.
And Mississippi bluegrass. Don't get me started. So the doctor hybridized. I can't say the word. He hybridized the most tolerant plants with some of with some very resistant varieties. So out of those, you know, 1,000 plants that he had, he just picked the best ones. And back in 2006, Dr. Phillips Mora finally released the first wave of these hybrid cacao plants, and his 6 hybrids are surviving very well, which is fantastic. They've proven to be disease resistant, and they produce 3 times the yield.
Hey, what?
And under ideal conditions, you know, ideal meaning the environment, the soil, the weather, temperature, everything, they can produce up to 6 times the previous crops. It's fantastic what he's achieved in his team. So the fungus rot that I mentioned
before. He needs a Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
So first, this fungus rot, it went from 75% to 5% with his plants, which is more good news. And he also, the doctor understood, just like Bob brought up, that his chocolate varieties have to taste good or else what's the point? It's vital to the success of the crop. Can't just look good, can't just grow big results, but it has to actually be flavorful. Unlike other crops that were replaced with a less tasty variety, like the Cavendish banana, like we said, his plants, the doctor's plants, are possibly even better than what we're used to. Because they were cultivating taste along the whole ride
that he's been doing this.
Wow.
Some of the beans are on the small size, which I'm not sure exactly what the impact of that is. You know, I don't know the process exactly to know, but that's definitely a negative. And none of the plants have been tested in other major growing theaters like Africa and Asia. So they're not sure how they're going to behave or if there's any pathogens that are resident to those areas of the world that could wipe them out. So they're doing it. They're actually, the researchers are making the modifications to solve some of these issues that they know they're going to be faced with. But we do know that the crop is stable where they're working on it. And, you know, it's the science is definitely working. But holy shit, if chocolate goes away, Steve, like, come on. Seriously, like, don't f*** around now. Like, let's get to the work, guys. The scientists, yes, start a Kickstarter. Do what you got to do, everyone, because...
Kickstarter.
A Kit-Kat starter.
Exactly. So anyway, you know, this is a pretty good example of how science can help us sustain crops, not just, you know, like not just wonderful things that we don't really need, like the Cavendish banana and chocolate, but, you know, this goes for all crops.
You know, imagine if this happened to rice, like a rice fungus, you know, forget about
rice, potatoes, bananas. I mean, they're all, staple crops. Wheat. We'd be screwed.
Basically, this is the problem of monoculture. You grow a million of something, something's going to evolve to eat it. That's the bottom line. And we need to prioritize genetic diversity in our crops.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Okay, Evan, if I'm sad, should I get my flu shot anyway?
Well, the short answer is yes, but hey, Steve, I have a 12-word poem I was going to start with.
Is it a haiku?
No, but it's about the flu.
All right.
So it's
that
germane.
Rhymed. Is
ready?
That a haiku? No, but it's about the flu.
One flew east, one flew west, one flew over the cuckoo's nest. Thank you. Popularized by the movie. But in any case, it's about the flu. And it is fall. It is fall, Steve. So it is time for everyone to get their flu shot. Get it by the end of October, please, according to the CDC. Now, the question of the day that Steve brought up, what kind of mood are you going to be in for your flu shot? So let's face reality. There's an inherent sort of, oh, damn, flu shot time again. What a drag. I hate needles, blah, blah, blah. The usual sort of dour that accompanies health visits, even for something as innocuous. See what I did there?
Oh, nice.
But thanks to a new study suggests you need to turn that flu frown upside down. Switch off your moody Judy and put on a happy face because gray skies are going to clear up. The better your mood, the better chance of the effectiveness of the flu vaccination. And the study was brought to us by the researchers at the University of Nottingham in the United Kingdom. You can read the full study online published in the journal Brain, Behavior, and Immunity. There were 128 test subjects. The age range of the subjects were 65 to 85. So we're talking about the older side of the population. Small sample, but the researchers examined several psychological and behavioral factors that have been shown to affect how well vaccinations work. The team measured negative mood, positive mood, physical activity, diet, and sleep. In the 6 weeks prior to getting the shot, the researchers examined each subject 3 times a week. That's a lot of examinations. And then they examined them during the inoculation. Then they examined them at 4 weeks after the inoculation, and they measured the level of influenza antibody in each participant. And finally, each subject was again measured for the antibody at 16 weeks out. The flu vaccination is estimated to be only effective in 17 to 53% of older adults in this category, compared to 70 to 90% of younger people. So they specifically chose this group for the fact that it's not as effective in this group. Oh, by the way, for 10 points, does anyone know what they call an inoculation in Britain or the United Kingdom?
Jab.
Anyone? Yeah, jab.
There you go, jab. They give it a, call it a jab. The researchers discovered that the only factor that showed any correlation to the shot's effectiveness was mood. Those who were the most upbeat in the 6 weeks leading up to the shot showed the highest level of antibody. And they said what stood out in particular was how influential a participant's mood was on the actual day of the shot. When the researchers looked at the influence on the day that they got the vaccination, they found an even greater effect on how well it worked, accounting for between 8% and 14% of the variability in antibody levels.
What the hell? That is really interesting and just strange.
It's actually not that strange.
Why?
Because stress releases cortisol, which is an immunosuppressing hormone. So pretty much anything that causes stress is going to suppress your immune system. And so it's not going to respond as much to the vaccine if you're under stress when you get it.
An interesting study, certainly worthy of follow-up. I'm sure they will follow up. It was small. It had limitations. There are most, you know, I believe it was Caucasians that they only had in the group. So they need to, you know, reach out to other types of people as well to see how they would do in a situation like this. Plus, the other factor was that all of the participants had the flu shot the year prior to this. So that was also, you know, kind of perhaps throws the numbers off in a sense. But it's, you know, it's interesting.
I mean, this study isn't enough to establish that it actually really makes a clinical difference. This is more of a proof of concept study. And I said it was limited, you know, I think
limited.
Its generalizability. But it's plausible, again, just because of the cortisol connection.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I would point out, don't let it stop you from getting the flu shot. Just get your flu shot.
Exactly. Right. Like, yeah. So I had to get a bunch of vaccines because I'm leaving the country, going to some developed place or not so developed places. And I have a cold. I have a bit of a cold. And I went to see my doctor and he refused to give me my vaccines. And I get it. Like, I know that doctors aren't supposed to give. I don't have a fever, by the way. I have not had a fever this entire time. And I know that if you're a little bit sick, if your immune system is working on overtime, it's quote unquote risky to give vaccines. But I mean, I look my doctor square in the eye and I was like, is it more risky to go to Africa without a typhoid vaccine?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm very confused right now. And I called up the clinic where they keep all the vaccines. It's like a traveler's clinic. And they were like, oh, you don't have a fever? No. Do you have a diagnosis? Not really. I mean, it's something viral, but nothing that I've no diagnosis. They're like, you're fine.
Yeah.
Why is that?
You're fine. Move
like,
on.
What is that about?
I don't think your doctor likes you.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It's just a general rule that you try not to vaccinate when somebody's sick, but he probably is not vaccinating a lot of people who are about to shuffle off to Africa. And didn't it's risk versus benefit. He probably just wasn't used to that very particular calculation, whereas the travel clinic was more familiar with that calculation. Like, I get those questions all the time for patients who have autoimmune disease. Like, do I get my vaccination? Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of a complicated calculus. It all comes down to risk versus benefit. You have to make an individual decision. But if you're not used to making that decision, you could, you know, it's easy just to err on the side of caution, which usually means I don't want to be the direct agent of harm.
Exactly. Right. I'll let somebody else deal with it.
Call me Vector.
Yeah. All right. So there's another news item going around with headlines such as therapy wakes vegetative state patient.
I saw that.
Vegetative state patient responds to therapy. Those are the sort of the clickbaity headlines, but it's an interesting study. It's one of these, you know, oh yeah, that's interesting. But it's not like there's not a dramatic clinical effect here. So, but let me tell you what's interesting about it and then, you know, pull back the hype a little bit. So they looked at it. There was indeed a patient. It's really a case study, an individual patient who was in a vegetative state for 15 years following a car accident. So a vegetative state by definition means you have no response to your environment. You may open and close your eyes, have roving eye movements, have sleep-wake cycles, but you don't respond to any stimulation in your environment. There's also something called a minimally conscious state, which is one notch above vegetative. It means you have some response to the environment, but it's minimal, as the name implies.
So you think for both those states, there's really nobody home? There's not somebody inside that could be like shrieking like, holy crap.
Minimally conscious, there could be somebody home, but they're probably not experiencing their existence the way somebody who's fully conscious does. And with a, and the, honestly, the bottom line is we just don't know.
Right. That's
is a persistent vegetative state the same as being brain dead?
No. Being brain dead means you have no cortical or subcortical brainstem function, even basic reflexes.
Where, so in this case, you have subcortical, you have like brainstem function.
Yes, by definition, yeah, so exactly. Gotcha. Yeah, you have brainstem function, you breathe, you know, you may be able to breathe, you may have sleep-wake cycle, you have some automatic movements, you have autonomic responses, but you don't have any conscious thought. Yeah. So that's, you're vegetative, but you're not, brain dead means nothing, not even brainstem functioning. You're at that.
Then I can see why it's hard for people to pull the plug, you know, because there is still this like basic kind of lizard brain activity happening. It must be very difficult.
Yeah,
for
you need somebody to explain
members.
To you that they're not home, they're not home and they're in a persistent vegetative. However,
brain dead is dead. I mean,
you're
dead,
a corpse.
Dead.
You're a corpse.
Yes. Yeah, brain dead means you're on a heart lung machine, right? Like it means you can keep the tissue alive, long enough, but your brain is dead.
Yeah, because breathing is a brainstem function. So if you're breathing, you're not brain dead. Okay, but we also have to distinguish between people who are vegetative or minimally conscious due to trauma versus people who are that way due to a diffuse brain injury, like an anoxic ischemic injury. Like your heart stops, your brain doesn't get oxygen for a few minutes, your brain cells throughout your cortex are damaged, and that's why you're in a coma, versus somebody who's in a car accident who has physical damage to their brain. These are two different situations. The reason being that somebody who's that way from trauma may have parts of the brain that are still working and may have some focal deficits like weakness, deafness, etc., that makes their exam look a lot worse than their overall brain function is. Does that make sense? So if you have two people with similar exams, they both look either vegetative or minimally conscious, but one got that way through a diffuse injury, like lack of oxygen, and the other person got that way through trauma, there's a possibility that the trauma patient may have some hidden neurological function, whereas the diffuse injury patient, they're gone. And now there have been multiple studies looking at this, looking at patients who are persistent vegetative, and some of them may actually be minimally conscious. Turns out they're all the trauma patients.
Yeah.
And some of them may have more cortical activity than we thought, and they're all the trauma patients. The diffuse injury patients, they're just always gone, which kind of makes sense. So this patient is in that category. They're there for trauma. So it's possible that they have some hidden cortical activity that we're not seeing because some of that there's focal damage somewhere. Now, one type of focal damage that can mask cortical potential or cortical activity is when the deep parts of the brain that are responsible for stimulating the cortex and keeping it awake are injured. And that would be the thalamus and the brainstem. The cortex needs to be constantly alerted in order to maintain a wakeful conscious state. And if those signals aren't constantly pinging the cortex, you'd be in a coma, even if your cortex was 100% intact, right? There are people who have this situation. Their cortex is normal, but they're, you know, their deeper structures are gone, and so they're in a coma because their brain stem is their brain is essentially permanently asleep. So, all right. So, with all that as background, we take this guy who has trauma, and what the researchers did was they gave him vagal nerve stimulation. So you hook up electrodes to the vagal nerve, which then could be used to stimulate the brain stem and the thalamus, basically. Mainly the thalamus. And we do this, for example, in certain seizures because that stimulation could sort of suppress a seizure and keep it from spreading. But what they did was we wonder if we stimulate the thalamus in this patient to replace the alerting, you know, wakeful signals that the thalamus usually gives the cortex, if that might help wake this person up a little bit. That is, in fact, what they found. They went from being clinically in a persistent vegetative state to clinically being in a minimally conscious state. And
they
also
went up that one notch.
They went up that one notch. And also their EEG showed a little bit more activity. This is like the small – they saying that they quote-unquote awoke from a persistent vegetative state. And they the clickbait did put it in scare quotes. But it's like that's – really misleading, you know, unless you know all the background. They weren't able to wake up and converse and engage in their life. They just were, they were having some really borderline reactions to their environment.
Yeah, like, so they could follow an object, right? Which not, is, which is a, right?
Not even. Not even. Right?
Are you sure?
Not even.
I thought they opened that they could actually follow.
Well, they not turning to stimulation and following, like tracking stimulation, are two different things.
Okay.
They were not tracking. They were
so
responding.
They turned.
But they
stirred.
But that's a little bit harder to interpret. They also, like, for example, when the doctor went right up to the face of the patient, they opened their eyes in reaction, almost like a startle reflex. But here's the thing. Other neurologists reading the detail, including myself, reading the details of the description of what the patient was doing, didn't find it very convincing. It's possible that this person had more clinical activity with the thalamic stimulation through the vagal nerve stimulator, but it's not 100% clear. It could be a little bit of overinterpretation of random things that the person's doing. So you can't rule it out. It's possible. And the fact that the EEG showed increased activity makes it more plausible, but it's not a home run. It's not clear. We can't hang our hat on it. It wasn't clear cut, like, oh yeah, this guy is tracking an object. There's no question he's interacting with this object. There was nothing like that.
So there's a good chunk of subjectivity.
There's subjectivity and therefore doubt.
Yep.
So is there an argument to be made, and again, stop me if I'm overreaching, between the comfort level of a patient who is actually in a persistent vegetative state versus minimally conscious? Like, I don't know. If I'm minimally conscious, am I more likely to feel pain and discomfort?
Yes.
So I might actually prefer to just be completely unconscious.
No. Yeah, that's a perfectly reasonable question to ask. And again, we just don't know, because people who come out of that state aren't really able to tell us what the experience was like. Yeah. Now, if you're locked in, that is yet another state where you're actually awake, you're just paralyzed. Those patients can tell us what their experience was like, and they are miserable.
Yeah, while they're locked in.
Yeah, so they're basically, like, paralyzed from the eyes down, right? They're awake, they just can't move anything. That's the worst case scenario.
Right, but that's nothing like that.
Minimally conscious.
Vegetative state.
Yeah. Totally different. Totally different. Minimally conscious. Yeah, you know, there's something going on in there, but it's not enough to generate really full wakefulness. And it's just not generating memories of actual experiences. And so we don't know.
Yeah, it's like if a tree falls in the forest, can you hear it? If you feel pain when you're only
when you're not forming memories, does it matter? Yeah.
It's just hard. That's a good question. Can they actually determine if consolidation, if memory consolidation is happening? Are we at that level where we could say, yeah, there's some new memories that are forming?
Well, you can only know based on recall. Like, we don't have any sort of tool to go into the brain to see memories being formed.
Not yet.
We can only ask the person if they remember them. And if they never climb up the consciousness ladder, then we're never going to be able to talk to them.
And when they do, their memory of what was happening when they were not fully conscious is dreamlike, suspect, or nothing.
Blurry.
Yeah.
Steve, what do you do for patients that are locked in?
You know, make them as comfortable as you can.
Oh, well, I mean, give them supportive care to communicate with them. You could communicate.
You try to communicate with them.
Communicate.
Jay, there are computer systems that will actually let you communicate with through a computer using just your eye, where you're focusing your eyes. Because computers.
Yeah, we've talked about locked in on the show before. I have a friend who's got ALS, and he's fully locked in, and he's like really, really. Active in the sense that he has a very good chair. He has, you know, he's trached. He has a good, really supportive care and palliative care. And, you know, we don't know how long he has. So he's there. He goes outside with his kids. He does stuff all the time. And so I think a lot of it depends on your socioeconomic status.
Yeah, absolutely.
It depends on your desire to do, like, he lives for something because he has a big ALS foundation and he does a lot of work to raise money.
That's great.
And he's locked in. He's locked in.
And he's locked in. Yeah.
Damn.
I mean, I think I don't know if he's fully locked in, but I think he's basically where
getting close. Yeah.
Where Hawking is, you know, he's, for all intents and purposes, locked in. If your eyes can still twitch, does that really make a big difference? I don't know.
But you're still locked in, even if you don't move your eyes, it's still considered locked in.
Well, there you go. Or your cheeks. Yeah. So I don't think he can't do anything. He can't lift his arms or anything. I don't think he can verbalize anymore. So,
but also just to finish up on this, so this is not the first study to look at this approach. There are other centers which did a similar thing. They implanted a chip in somebody's brain to, again, replace the thalamic stimulation of the cortex, and they also improved their function. That was actually more convincing than this one. And there are some studies looking at pharmacological ways of doing this. There's, for example, some patients in this type of state have awakened temporarily in response to Ambien, which is was paradoxical and weird. Not really sure we understand that yet. So, but the other sort of question that this raises is, let's say that the report is accurate, that the person had improved responsiveness. Was that due to the moment to moment stimulation of the vagal nerve, or because they were doing that for 6 months? Was there some plasticity? Was it actually like making new connections and then the patient woke up due to that? But it does seem like he really only had this improved function while he was being stimulated. So these are baby steps, you know, and this one is even a questionable baby step, but the goal is to get to the point where we could actually like functionally replace some parts of the brain that are broken and try to get as much function out of the not damaged parts of the brain as possible. But that's obviously limited in its potential because it's limited to how much of the brain has the potential to function in the first place. What we really need is the ability to, you know, repair brain damage, which we can't do now. But, you know, imagine if we could, you know, inject neuronal stem cells into a person like this brain, and they could replace, you know, a large number of neurons. They may have tremendous amounts of amnesia, of memory loss, but they may be able to replace some of their lost function, at least enough to be awake and participate in their life. But we're a long way away from that at this point. We're nowhere near the point where saying somebody a treatment, you know, woke them from a coma is anything other than misleading. Okay, let's move on. Bob, so I understand Russia and the United States are going to collaborate on a moon mission.
Yeah, this really knocked my socks off in a lot of ways. Not even really the Russian angle. But surprising as it sounds, Russia and the U.S. agreed recently to work together on a NASA project to build the first ever frickin' lunar space station.
Finally.
I mean, and that's really the biggest part of the news item is a lunar space station. Did you guys even hear about this? I hadn't heard about this. This was apparently announced early in 2017. So months ago, if I caught a hint of this, I would have jumped on it, didn't see it. NASA said they were exploring this idea. You know, it was exploratory phase. I mean, if this is true, this would basically the best news in decades for human space exploration. You know, not robot space exploration, but human. So they call it Deep Space Nine. Whoops, sorry. Gateway. Space Gateway. DSG.
Got me all excited there. I perked right up. I was like, that would be awesome.
Deep Space Gateway, DSG. That's still a cool name. NASA says that means it's a gateway to deep space, if it wasn't obvious, but also to the moon's surface, which I find probably even more interesting. For the long trip to lunar orbit, NASA will be using its two newest toys that are nearing completion. It's the Huge Space Launch System, or SLS rockets, will soon be the mightiest rockets ever launched, eventually even eclipsing the legendary Saturn V. Oh my God. That finally, you know, it only took over half a century. We could do years. Better than something we had 50 years ago, blah. So, and the crew will be, the crew will be, well, but that's because we've been focusing on low Earth orbit and not focusing much beyond
space
that.
Shuttle
so,
program.
So, yeah. And the crews will be aboard the new 4-person crew capsule, the Orion crew module. This will be the first time since Apollo that humans will have a presence beyond Earth orbit. So the orbit itself, even the orbit itself is fascinating. It's not a conventional orbit as you might think. You might think, oh, you fly to the moon and go into orbit around the moon. No, that's so simplistic. It's not what's going on here. This is called a cislunar orbit. Hello, Kara.
CIS?
Or near rectilinear halo orbit. Which I had never even heard of before. So this is
rectilinear.
Jay heard of it.
And Bob, there is a translunar orbit, right?
Yeah, which I think is on, yes, you're right. I think that's on the other side of the cislunar orbit, on the other
that's
side
crazy.
Of the Earth.
We didn't even plan this.
Oh, I know, right? When you were saying this, I was like, oh, cool. I was so excited. So so the gravitational fields of the Earth and Moon basically essentially create an equilibrium point or a Lagrange point where a smaller body can essentially park with minimal energy or sometimes I think even no energy, just hang out. And it's kind of like where the gravitational forces are balancing out. So we've talked about that on the show a few times. Lagrange points are fascinating in and of themselves, but you could actually orbit around these Lagrange points. And that's a halo orbit. Now, this specific orbit that the DSG will use will bring it from 1500 kilometers to 70,000 kilometers from the moon. So that's the kind of orbit. It's going to be this looping orbit where it goes really close and then kind of farther away and then really close and then kind of far away. The key, though, is that you're always within easy reach of the moon. Even when you're at, you know, is it aphelion, the farthest distance, you are still, you know, 70,000 kilometers, not that far. It's not going to take much energy to get to the moon. But why even go to the moon when you're 70,000 kilometers away? Just wait a little while and you'll soon be 1,500 kilometers away, much closer, even less energy. So that's kind of the point there. You're always kind of within easy reach of the moon. So now the goals of the Deep Space Gateway include studying the effects of living outside Earth's protective magnetosphere. That's kind of important. If we want to actually set up shop on the moon or in Mars, which everyone's talking about, or for decades now, we got to know, you know, what is it like when you're outside the magnetosphere? But also longer term, a long-term goal is eventually constructing the deep space transport required to get to Mars, get your ass to Mars. So that's kind of the goal. But I was kind of disappointed that there wasn't more focus on a lunar base, finally getting my moon base Alpha. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But there was some talk about that as well. Mm-hmm. Acting administrator at NASA, Robert Lightfoot, said, while Deep Space Gateway is still in concept formulation, NASA is pleased to see growing international interest in moving into cislunar space as the next step for advancing human space exploration. Now, cislunar space in this context means basically, you know, between the Earth and the moon. That's essentially what they're saying. So, but now other countries, back to the Russia angle now, other countries have been working on their contributions for the DSG, but Russia has been pretty quiet until recently. The Russian space agency Roscosmos said Russians and Americans would cooperate to build the systems needed to organize scientific missions in lunar orbit and to the surface of the moon. So I know it makes sense to be skeptical about this whole Russia angle with all the craziness in the news about U.S.-Russia relations, all the tensions, all the craziness over the Ukraine and Syria aspects of this. But the fact remains, the space seems immune to all of this historically. You know, we've worked side by side with Russians on the International Space Station for years. They've made, you know, some big contributions. So that so far that kind of work beyond, you know, in low Earth orbit seems kind of immune to this. And hopefully that could be extended into the future as well. Roscosmos's general director, Igor Komarov, said recently, we understand that we are key players and we have to work on these missions together. So that's wonderful. Plus, there's the fact that, like the ISS, they have much to contribute to a lunar space station. I mean, come on, they've got tons of experience in life support systems, docking technology, to name just a couple things. They are no slouches at all. And they've done, not only do they have some practical experience, but they've done lots of research, you know, on the ground on what's going to be required for things like, say, lunar rovers and things like that. So in addition, they have additional motivation to help with this effort. Now, consider this. One of their main goals is to actually have a long-term lunar base, which I think is a wonderfully awesome goal, a goal that we need to take more seriously. So imagine that. That's, of course, expensive. Plus, their cosmonaut ferrying super heavy lift rockets was recently pushed back. The development was pushed back to the end of the 2020s, at least. So working with NASA on this lunar space station makes more sense
for them in that context. When you consider that context, it's very beneficial because, you know, they could use our our SLS rockets for a while to get to the moon, so they could take advantage of all of that until, you know, their rockets are all set and whatever. So this is definitely to their advantage. Beyond that, they may be looking to team up beyond the moon as well. Putin said, for example, he said, in particular, there is interest in joint efforts with the Americans in exploration of Mars by 2030. But, you know, it's Putin. Who the hell knows what he's really thinking here. But it would be nice if we could be partners, real partners in something, like this. Even if we can't really get our shit together, on the Earth. All right. So when could this happen? I mean, some of the numbers, some of the dates actually sound, really make me really hopeful. So construction of the DSG could start as early as 2021. Which is not that far away. You know, this isn't something that they're talking about. Oh yeah, 15 years, we'll start doing this. I mean, 2021, they could actually launch the SLS with its first crew beyond low Earth orbit and then deliver that first module to the Deep Space Gateway. And then over the course of the years, by 2026, they could have all four modules could be there. I mean, that's not too far away. I think we should work on this space station in conjunction with a moon base Alpha, because as we've said on the show before, I really think we need to get our shit together on the moon first before we even think of going to Mars. I mean, I think it's so ridiculous. Let's go to Mars. Yeah, let's go to Mars, but let's practice and get our techniques and our technology and everything together on the moon, because, you know, worst case scenario, you know, you're three days away from the Earth. That's not bad. That's a lot better than 6 months away. You know,
at best, yeah.
I think it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, at best. It really is.
So, Bob, you're saying that we should keep everything in the Alpha Quadrant.
Yes, for quite some time, in fact.
In the Terran system.
All right, Kara.
Yes.
Do jellies dream?
Possibly. Seems to be the answer. Well, dream, we have no idea, actually. But sleep, the answer seems to be possibly. Mm. And why do you guys think that this is such an interesting finding?
Well, because the neurological system of the jelly.
Yes, they don't have brains. So, and also, this happened in my backyard at Caltech. Ravi Nath, Claire Bedbrook, and Michael Abrams, along with a few other co-authors, they're grad students at Caltech, and they were wondering whether or not jellyfish sleep. And apparently, when they asked a lot of different people, experts in the field, as well as lay individuals, everyone said something different. And they thought, we need to try and get to the bottom of this. So they started with, I guess it's a genus, Cassiopeia. Yeah, I would assume, because it's capitalized. So that would be Cassiopeia species. They started with Cassiopeia, which almost looks like an upside down jellyfish. They tend to hang out. Oh, well, I know. We keep calling them jellyfish. They call them jellyfish, too. They actually call it the jellyfish Cassiopeia exhibits a sleep light state. That is the title of the paper in Current Biology.
Oh, boy.
But maybe Cassiopeia jellyfish is referred to as jellyfish for that reason. I don't know. Maybe that's its like proper title. I don't know. But I can call them sea jellies if it makes you feel better. So the Cassiopeia, we'll just call it that. It looks like an upside down sea jelly in that it's the bowl sort of faces downward and the tentacles seem to go upward. And it likes to hang out at the surface. It doesn't swim much. And the water just kind of flows over its tentacles. And they devised this algorithm. Actually, they had been looking at Cassiopeia, I think, in their own apartment, like in a tank. And they realized that, it seemed to be quieter at night, quieter in the sense that it had less activity. And they were like, we need to actually look at this scientifically. They devised an algorithm that would actually count how many times it undulated during the day versus at night. And they found that there was a 30% reduction in undulation of these bells in pulsations at night. And it's a little bit hard to say whether or not they're actually sleeping at that point, just that they're more quiet at night or less active. So they decided that they needed to look at a couple different things. They said, okay, first of all, is it less active? Sure. But also, is it reversible, right? Like, if you rouse them, will they sort of take a while and then wake up? And that's what they found, that when they roused them from this sleep state, they sort of were groggy for a minute, like they were slow to respond. And then they started pulsating at regular intervals as if they were awake during the day. And then the other thing that they thought was, okay, will it take longer to rouse them, right? So not just are they going to be slower to respond after, but are they going to not quite hear us or feel us when we first try to rouse them? Just like when somebody's asleep and you're like, Evan! And then I have to like poke
that's
you.
That's kind
of
creepy.
That is
a little creepy. And so they did the jelly version of that with a PVC pipe and a screen bottom. They tend to hang out. They don't like to be suspended. So they would lift the pipe in the water and then drop it, and it would force the jelly to be suspended. They didn't like that. And so they would swim down to the surface. But if they did that same experiment at night, they were really, really slow to swim down. And then the last thing was sleep deprivation. They were like, if this is sleep, then there has to be a function for it. And one way we can test that is to see if they don't sleep, what happens? And so they found that if they kept the jelly awake all night by like blowing water over it to keep, like with water jets to keep it stimulated, that it would be active, you know, just like it were during the day. And then the next day, even during the day, they were like crappy. They didn't move much, and they exhibited more of these nighttime type reactions. So it seemed as if they were sleep deprived, and they needed to make up for it by quote unquote sleeping during the day. Although some researchers argue that this really isn't sleep, and there's really no way to test sleep unless you actually put electrodes on a jelly and look at their brain waves. Other researchers say that's absolutely not true. We do that with mammals and birds, but we can't do that with fish, and we don't do that with insects. And we generally think of those organisms as having sleep. We just look at their behavior. So I think there's some argumentation within the field of what actually constitutes sleep. And obviously, there's no way to test if they have analogs of human sleep, like REM sleep. They don't seem to have REM sleep, you know, but like there's no way to really know, at least not with the approaches that we've used thus far. But they did play around with some drugs. That was really fun. They dosed the animals with melatonin, and they found that they did pulse more slowly. It slowed down their activity. Who knows if it induced sleep, but it did cause them to slow down a bit. They gave the jellies antihistamine, which usually makes people drowsy. They also seem to be quote unquote drowsy. They pulsed more slowly. And then I love this quote from one of the researchers, Bed Brook. And we did try caffeine and we didn't see anything though. And then another researcher chimed in. So not everything works. We wanted to say something about giving coffee to jellies, but it didn't work out. Would have made a good headline.
Yeah.
So yeah, the question here is, And part of the reason that this is so interesting is, A, as we just described, jellies don't actually have brains. They just have a nerve net, like this loose grouping of neurons that actually runs around the rim of where the bells move. When you look at the animal kingdom kind of writ large, you see that a lot of organisms, fish sleep, fish have brains, flies sleep, flies don't have brains, they have ganglia. Nematode worms seem to sleep, but they only have ganglia. So it's not really that interesting when you think of it that way. Okay, well, sure, jellies don't have brains, but flies and worms sleep. So why is this interesting? Well, jellies belong to an animal group that actually split off from all of these other creatures at least 600 million years ago. So they're evolutionarily much, much older. And it really kind of pushes back the age of when sleep evolved as a behavior to evolutionary biologists. So
yeah, but we don't know if this is homologous or analogous.
Absolutely. Yeah, right? We don't. And we also don't know if it's even sleep.
Is it right? Which is interesting. But I mean, it could suggest that the need for something like sleep is really fundamental to just neurons, not even brains, that they just need to be take a break every now and then to recover, and they suffer if they don't.
And at that point, isn't defining sleep as just taking a break? I mean, it's a very broad definition, but in the grand scheme of things, it is meaningful, right? Whether or not we're identifying it as slow wave or REM or, you know, all these different aspects, those are just ways to quantify sleep. But just neurons taking a break, I mean, at what point? Yeah. Consciousness is fuzzy. We were just talking about that. The idea of consciousness has very fuzzy limits. Like the difference between sleep and wakefulness, it's very easy for us to experience, right, as humans, and to be able to try and talk about. But the actual measurements involved, the scientific exploration of it, it's got fuzzy boundaries.
Right. But you could say something like this, just neurons taking a break, you know, might have evolved into more sophisticated sleep mechanisms because, you know, we're more sophisticated creatures. We need to shut down, you know, and we can't just, you know, have our neurons shut down. We have to, other stuff is going to happen, you know, so sleep evolved. And that that clearly happened, but the question is, what was the fundamental beginning of it? Was it sort of after more, you know, something like brains where it came about, or even at least ganglia, or really was it at the neuronal level? And but again, we don't know if jellies just independently developed this pattern of behavior, or if this really is kind of all precursor. Yeah, does it all go to the same evolutionary route? Yeah, that would be
exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it speaks to, I think, why this is such an interesting topic as a whole, is that, you know, we don't fully understand why we sleep. We know we need it. And there are a lot of different competing hypotheses. And there are certain things we do know about it. But in general, that core of the question, like, why do we need to be rendered unconscious every day, is still kind of
mystery,
an enigma.
A mystery.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy.
It's a Disney World animatronic gone haywire.
Yeah.
No.
On acid. It was insane sounding.
It's the chipmunks playing motor cars.
I love that.
All right. So I got a good number of guesses this week. A lot of people were trying to be funny, as you could imagine.
Well, it does lend itself to that.
But one listener named Gil Caspi said, it sounds like the symphony composed by one of Google's deep learning systems. Nope, that's not correct, but I thought that was interesting. Ian Hollis wrote in and said, I think today's noise is an audio representation of energy released by collisions and a particle accelerator. That's cool, but that's not the case for this noisy either. Just thought that was interesting. The winner this week is Eduardo Garcia, and Eduardo said, is the noise the rings of Saturn?
What?
Yes. So something really cool happened this week. I got an email from a man named Matt Russo, who is one of the three people who created this noisy.
Ah. Oh,
yes.
That's awesome.
Said, I'm going to read the email. And I
so he got it right, basically.
Yes, he got it right. Well, he was basically just writing. He was like, Jay, but check it out. So he writes, hey, Jay, I can't tell you how excited I was to hear you use a noisy I created for Who's That Noisy? You may have seen the info at systemsounds.com/more-saturn-sounds. But if you want another explanation, here goes. These ripples are launched as at resonances with the moon Janus, which is actually joined by a smaller sister moon, Epimetheus. Epimetheus. That's me. Okay. Epimetheus. In the same orbit. Are you following me? Ready? Here we go. The most dramatic wave is at the 2-to-1 resonance where the ring particles complete two orbits with Janus and Epimetheus complete one. The rhythmic gravitational tugs launch waves that bunch up as they propagate away from the point of resonance. Converting these density waves to sound waves lets you hear subtle changes in the wavelengths that are not apparent visually, and even lets you hear very faint waves which you may not even be able to see in the images. Not to mention the benefit of sonification for the visually impaired. Okay, so that was, you know, very sciencey, very cool. I kind of get what he's talking about. And he says at the end, the best part is that Janus and Epimetheus swap orbits every 4 years. They slide past each other and one moves slightly in while the other moves slightly out. This resets the launch points of the wave, causing the repeated upward swoops, so you can hear the history of their moon dance in the wave. Very cool, Matt. What the hell?
That is cool.
Very cool. I'm very, you know, just incredibly psyched that that you decided to make sounds out of all this data that you guys collect. Thank you, Alex, for sending this in, and thank you, Matt, for emailing me. That was really fun. And thanks for everyone who submitted a guest this week. I'm going to make an announcement. This was the week that the most people sent me in the best noisies I've ever gotten.
Wow, nice.
Wow.
Yeah, I got an awesome, awesome cache of noisies right now. Thank you all so much. It's really cool because, you know, I vet these noises quite a bit. You know, I email people back saying, hey, is that a real sound? Can you vet the sound for me? You know, a lot of times it's just unusable, even though I think it's interesting, it wouldn't work on the show. But for some reason, you know, the stars lined up. It was the end of the world. Maybe everyone was saving their good noisies for September 23rd. But I got a ton of great noisies. So thank you guys. And please do continue to send them in. I've got a new noisy this week I think you're really going to think is cool. Check this out. So that was sent in by a listener named Mick Orberg. Thank you, Mick. Very cool. You know, could be anything.
Could be anything. Is it?
Has a sciencey sci-fi sound to it, which I always think is fun. I will give you a clue, and the clue is that without this, there would be no life.
Okay.
The strong nuclear force.
So you can email me any cool noises you heard this week or any guesses that you have to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. So our email this week is actually a bunch of emails. So we got a ton of emails about the Celsius Fahrenheit discussion. So I guess people are interested in that. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to do a little follow up. So a lot of people pointed out or were defending Celsius as a temperature. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity to clarify what my position is. I was being, just for comic effect, a little provocative last week, but seriously, this is what I honestly think about the whole Celsius Fahrenheit thing. So first of all, my main point is that Celsius is not metric in the way that other measurements are metric, because, you know, like kilometers, meters, and millimeters are, you know, are obviously all base 10. They divide into each other by 10, right? That's the primary advantage to the metric measurements. Mm-hmm. Celsius doesn't have that. There's just, you don't divide or multiply or whatever. There's just no advantage to, you know, water freezing to boiling being 0 to 100. It's totally arbitrary. So if we compare the Celsius Fahrenheit systems to decide which one is better, I think it actually is, at the end of the day, actually it's a wash. So a lot of people pointed out that water freezing at zero was convenient. It's like, okay, I'll buy that. I see that that's a minor convenience. But the implication is that, like, it's really hard to remember that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but it really isn't.
No. I mean,
if you grow up in the Fahrenheit system, it's like, it's fine. You know, I consider that, okay, that it would be reasonable if you're crafting a temperature system to make water freezing at zero, even for everyday use. I'll buy that. Water boiling at 100, worthless. I maintain that that's utterly worthless. It never.
I so disagree.
It's never come up in my life. It has never, ever come up in my life.
But 212 is so random.
Yeah, but when do you need to know that in everyday life?
Why does it need to be base 10?
I don't know. You need to know when you go to the spa. Whatever. You need to know it when you look at a thermometer.
No, when? Why? When do you know? You need to know when water boils. You boil water. You don't do it by a thermometer.
What if you're cooking? Yeah, what if you're making candy or one of those types of cooking things where you need really, really specific temperature?
Yeah, then you know the temperature you need and you use that temperature. But knowing that water boils at 100 doesn't matter.
Yeah, but isn't there also water will boil at different temperatures depending on
elevation,
the pressure?
Yeah, it's actually much more narrow than that. It's at a specific pressure and only a specific temperature range is the technical definition of Celsius, but that's a minor point. And then if we look at the granularity of the two temperature systems, I think Fahrenheit has an advantage over Celsius.
Yeah, I think that's your strongest argument.
I disagree, though, because you just put a decimal point and then all of a sudden it's just as granular.
Oh, great.
But it really isn't. It really isn't. Because think about it. 0 to 100 is perfect. We live between 0 and 100. You know, the 60s have a certain feel. The 70s have a certain feel. It's the perfect amount of granularity. Yeah. For Celsius, it's like negative 10 to 50 and you throw a decimal point after it, then you have too much granularity. It's not in the sweet spot. It's just not in the sweet spot.
I think people who live with it argue that it's different for them. I think it's one of
no,
those
it's
things
fine.
Where if you
I think
grew
I think,
up with it, that's how you feel. Right. You feel like this is the right way for it to be.
Do they bake their cookies at 150 degrees Celsius? Sure. Is that what
if you yeah. grew up with one system or the other, it's intuitive for you. It makes sense and it's fine.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with that. And again, if you're adapted to Celsius, it's fine. But my point is, unlike the other metric measurements, it's not inherently superior. That's my only point. It's got, maybe you could give it one advantage with the zero being freezing. I would give Fahrenheit the advantage for having a more useful range. Now, for science, Celsius wins hands down. No question, because it's integrated into the other metric systems as we discussed. But that was, they decided to integrate it into it, right? That's, it's nothing inherent about the range itself. It's just that they integrate it. But a lot of people pointed out that for science, you're going to use Kelvin anyway.
Yeah, Kelvin.
Right?
It depends on it. Not in like biological lab science. You only use Kelvin in physics and maybe some chemistry.
Yeah.
I kind of disagreed when I saw that email. I was like, what do you mean all science uses Kelvin? No. When we're talking about space, we use Kelvin. And when we're talking about, things that are happening at the molecular level. But generally speaking, applied sciences almost always use Celsius.
But you could theoretically say that you could use Kelvin for all science and Fahrenheit for temperature,
yeah.
and then
Kelvin.
You're fine.
Now, this is just your way of getting Celsius off.
Well, I'm just saying, just to happen to be true. No, but here's the thing: if they were not so locked into such a narrow view of what it meant to be metric, they could have made the Celsius temperature scale be water freezes at zero. And water boils at 200. And if they had done that, it would be perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they missed their opportunity, their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to do that. They got locked into it has to be 100 because reasons, because it makes no sense when you think about it, because you're never going to really be divided, because you can't really multiply and divide Celsius. You can Kelvin, because that's an actual temperature scale, because it goes to absolute zero, but you can't really do that in Celsius anyway, so it makes no sense. So they should have made it 0 to 200, then I would be totally on board with Celsius. All right.
Botched it.
He has spoken.
All right, Steve, did you get it out of your system?
I did.
Okay, so we don't need to talk about it anymore.
That's right. Hey, unless we get 20 more emails, then I'll talk about it again.
Oh, now, all right. You're going to get 220 emails now.
Here we go. 220, 221, whatever it takes.
200. You're going to get 212 emails on this.
All right. You guys ready for science fiction?
Oh, gosh. Wow. Okay.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Jay, we have a little coincidence here on the science or fiction, because I didn't know what your noisy was.
Winky dink.
But the theme for the science or fiction this week is Saturn.
All right.
It's things we learned about Saturn from Cassini, which we talked about recently, just having its grand finale.
Cassini!
Are you ready?
That's what the Jawas said, right?
Yes. Oh,
cheating. These are things you may not know about what we learned so much about Saturn from Cassini. There's so many details.
Awesome.
Here are some maybe you may have heard or maybe you didn't hear. Ready? Item number one, observations of Saturn's rings show the possible formation of a new moon from the outer edge. This suggests that ring material may not only rain inward into Saturn, but move outward, forming new moons. Item number two, Cassini's long-term observations were used to calculate the length of Saturn's day for the first time. And item number three, Saturn's moon Titan has hundreds of times as much hydrocarbons on its surface than all the oil and gas reserves on Earth. Evan, you haven't gone first in a while. Go first.
No, I haven't gone first in a while. All right. First one, a new moon from the outer edge of the rings of Saturn. Interesting. Ring material may not only rain inward to Saturn, but move outward, forming new moons. Well, this is very possible. A moon doesn't have to be that big. You probably wouldn't need that much material maybe to classify it. as a moon. So I think that's in that sense, it's possible. But how is it really doing it? What other forces are happening here that keep the material from raining down onto Saturn and instead hanging out to make a new moon? Very cool. Second one. This is about the length of Saturn's day for the first time. You would think that we would have been able to peg that from Earth, but I recall watching recently about the Voyager show on PBS. They did the 40-year retrospective, and they were talking about how really lousy a lot of our Saturn pictures were until we sent the Voyager spacecraft out that way. We had really bad sort of data on it, but maybe we were able to calculate it from the Voyager. Well, that would have been the only time we could have done it, but Voyager probably didn't do that, the Voyager missions. So I'll think this one is science. And then the last one, Titan, hundreds of times as much hydrocarbons on its surface than all the oil and gas reserves on the Earth. I don't know. We're learning more about oil and gas reserves on the Earth. We're still discovering oil and gas reserves on the Earth. They're finding huge amounts of oil and gas reserves on the Earth. So to say that it would be 100 times as much as we currently have, I'm not sure that they can really gauge that accurately. So I'm leaning towards, I guess I'll go with it. I'll say that Titan and the hydrocarbons one, I'll say that that one's the fiction, that it's not hundreds, it's maybe, I don't know, 10 times. So you upped it by a factor of 10.
Okay, so even though this is an astronomy one, Bob, I'm going to have you go second.
The moon forming from the outer edge of the rings. Yeah, rings can do some wacky stuff, I think, sometimes. There could be some weird resonances going on. I'm not sure. It just doesn't seem like that's totally out of the question. I wonder if that's outside the limit. Was it the Roche limit that determines? But my understanding was though that all the rings were within the Roche limit, meaning that they would eventually rain down. But the outer edge, I don't know. Let's see. Let's go to the next one. The length of Saturn's day. You know, I would have thought we'd have that nailed down to a certain extent before Cassini. That one, I'm not buying that one. Let's look at the last one though. Hundreds of times as many hydrocarbons. Sure, yeah. I mean, sure. That's certainly possible. It's not like it's, I mean, it's still it's named Titan for a reason. It's a big moon. All right. So yeah, nothing is really leaping out, much more than the second one. So, I'll say that the length of Saturn's day, we kind of knew that, you know, maybe not as accurately as we determined from Cassini, but based on what you have here, you're saying that we knew the length of Saturn's day for the first time. So I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Okay. So Bob thinks that the length of Saturn's day is fiction. Evan thinks that Titan having hundreds of times as much hydrocarbon on the surface than oil and gas reserves on Earth is fiction. So because this is a random crapshoot, I'm going to say that the formation of a new moon from the outer edge is the fiction.
All right.
See what you're doing there. Okay, Jay.
Thank you for taking one for the team, maybe, Kara.
Yep, we'll see. We'll see.
You as well, Bob.
Sweep. Ah, screw you.
And I could see Cassini, the observations of Saturn, you know, they're able to really narrow down the length of Saturn's day. Sure, I could see sharpening that. I'm sure we were really close, but they sharpened it. That one is not that big of a deal. This one about Titan having 100 times as much hydrocarbons on the surface. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I wonder if that has anything to do with the way it looks. I don't know. Don't know. That's an interesting one, though. And then this first one here is the one that I wasn't too hip on for a few reasons. One, I was reading about the rings recently and finding out what they're made out of. And then what would the moon actually be made out of? I mean, because it's a lot of that is like, it's not substantial material. It's just not, there's not a lot of material there. So I just don't know. That's why I think this one might be the fake. I'll go with Kara.
Okay. So, yeah, we have a pretty even divide. I guess I'll take these in order. Observations of Saturn's rings show the possible formation of a new moon from the outer edge. This suggests that ring material may not only rain inward onto Saturn, but move outward, forming new moons. Jay and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. And this one is science.
Damn.
Ooh. Yeah, this one is really interesting. So the rings, at least on Saturn, where it has an elaborate ring system, is like right between the outer and the inner limit of where they can be. So anything that's, you know, where the rings occupy this zone around Saturn where the gravity, the tides are such that a moon couldn't exist. It would rip it apart into smaller bits like the ring. And if it gets too close, it rains down on Saturn. The rings are basically everywhere in between. So at that outer edge, that's right at the limit where something larger like a moon could exist. And they observed this bright object forming right at the edge of Saturn's A ring. And they're not 100% sure, which is why I said suggests and possible, but it looks to them as if some of the ring material is sort of coming together to form a larger object like a moon. And they think that it might actually at some point break off from the outer ring and be its separate moon. And so it's possible that Saturn is losing its ring material both inward and outward. Which would be from the inner edge and the outer edge. That would be neat.
Neat.
Yeah. Cool, cool. Yeah, and Bob, you're right. The rings do. So there are so many funky things that we learned about the rings.
Yeah.
They have vertical structures. They have their interwoven.
Oh my God. The vertical structures. Did you see the picture with the shadows? Yeah. Spiky shadows. My God.
I almost used that, but I thought it was too well known already. Let's go on to number two. Cassini's long-term observations were used to calculate the length of Saturn's day for the first time. Bob, you think this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Well done, Bob.
But Bob, I predicted that somebody would be right for the wrong reason on this one.
I'll take it, but
and
tell me.
You are, because we still don't know how long Saturn's day is.
Still?
We don't know.
We crashed
into the cloud rotation.
We tried to figure it out with Cassini, but it was ambiguous. We never were able to nail it down. So one of the things we were trying to use was Saturn's radio signals, because, you know, Saturn has a magnetic field like Jupiter and it produces a pattern of radio signals, but it turns out that they're not consistent. And so we couldn't use them to measure the length of Saturn's day. And because it's complicated with the clouds and everything. So the bottom line is we still don't really have a solid measurement of Saturn's day.
But we do have Jupiter.
Yes.
More delineated storm systems?
Because of the magnetic field and everything, it is.
It's got an intense magnetic field.
Yeah.
What's Saturn's magnetic field like? I'm not sure.
It's got one, but yeah.
Not as intense as Jupiter, probably.
Not as intense as Jupiter, but it's relatively strong compared to other planets, like the Earth.
Mars is weak.
Mars has only regional
southern area
spotty
only,
at best.
Yeah. It's spotty and weak, and Mercury and Venus don't have one at all. Okay, this means that Saturn's moon Titan has hundreds of times as much hydrocarbons on its surface than all the oil and gas reserves on Earth. That one is science. And, you know, I know that you guys know that there's hydrocarbons on Titan. It was the amount that was really the question. And it is massive. You know, so Cassini discovered there's actually like lakes of methane, you know, on the surface of Titan.
Yikes.
Methane and ethane.
I think that was actually the first like freestanding liquid ever found on another planet besides Earth.
Right.
I'm pretty sure.
And tholins, you know what tholins are?
No.
Were those aliens on Star Trek that make the web? Yeah. Oh, that's tholian web. Sorry.
The tholins are complex organic molecules.
Okay.
And they actually think that there may be prebiotic chemistry on Titan.
Whoa.
There's just so much carbon.
Rocks.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's really cold, though. Really cold.
Oh, yeah, it's cold. Remember Kurt Vonnegut's book, The Sirens of Titan? Postulating about the was populated. Cool.
Imagine. It's a -179 degrees Celsius on Titan.
Yikes.
So any life that would be there would be moving mighty.
Steve, I don't understand. What is it in Fahrenheit?
-290
Thank that I get. Now that makes total sense to me. Thank you.
Hey, in case anybody was curious.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, that was me, Bob, and Steve doing a Star Trek review show of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
Just in case you were curious.
Sweet.
Alpha Quadrant 6. We have a Facebook page. We'll be doing that after every Star Trek Discovery episode for the first season. So check it out. Like us if you like it. Leave comments. We're going to be, you know, give us ideas. We're trying to develop this show. So I think the first episode was a lot of fun, but we're always looking for ways to improve.
I have a question. Yeah. Steve, what did you think of the Klingon language?
Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
I think the Klingons were a miss, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Oh, I love those little teasers. Tune in, though, to the show to see all the comments. It's good stuff.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
We especially need imagination in science. It's not all mathematics, nor all logic, but it's somewhat beauty and poetry. There will come, with the greater love of science, greater love to one another. Maria Mitchell, 19th century astronomer, American astronomer, in 1847, by using a telescope, discovered a comet, which as a result became known as Miss Mitchell's Comet. And she won a gold medal prize for her discovery, which was presented to her by King Frederick VI of Denmark. Very cool.
Oh, cool.
Good stuff.
Yeah. And that's a timely quote, and we talk about that a lot on the show, that, you know, science is a combination of rigor and imagination. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And there is sort of a poetry to the elegance of reality. And sometimes that speaks to us in a deep way, but sometimes that deep way is bias, and sometimes it's because there's an inherent sense there, or a symmetry, or, you know, a mathematical relationship or something that works, you know. Sometimes elegant solutions are elegant because they're correct. So I think it's good to be in touch with that, with all of these intellectual tools, you know, that we have to explore science.
Definitely, definitely. I think it was also impressive. It came from a 19th century female American astronomer. She's considered to be the first American woman to work as a professional astronomer.
Cool.
So that's very cool.
Bob, she ever make your forgotten superheroes of science?
I think she may have.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.